Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
We're here at Focus 580. Glad to have people listening this morning. And in the first part of the program, we're pleased to welcome back to the show a guest who has been with us before a number of times. His name is James Rybacki, and he is a member of the clinical faculty at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy. And his area of practice and interest is prescription medications. In fact, he has now for a number of years been authoring a book which is titled The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs. And it was first published in 1977. At that time, he was the co-author. Then he took over as the full author in 1996, and then has been the case now for all the years since. And it's updated every year. And in fact, the new edition, the one for 2006, is out now. It's published by HarperCollins. And it's a very useful thing. You might want to have this copy of this book on your shelf in your home, or you can, of course, go to the library and consult. And it has information on prescription medications, what they're for, potential side effects, potential interactions. And I think it can be a good source of information for people about the medicines that you and members of your family are taking. And when Dr. Rybacki joins us here on the program, we give people who are listening the opportunity to call in and ask questions about medicines that they may be taking. And that's what we can do here this morning. We hope that, of course, that people will make a contribution to WILL, but that's completely separate. That's a separate number. If you want to call 244-9455 and make a pledge, that would be great. But if you have a question here for our guest, you just call the regular number, which is 333-9455. That's the one for Champaign-Urbana folks. We do also have, by the way, a toll-free line so that it will not cost you anything to make the call if it would be a long-distance call. That's 800-222-9455. Use one or the other of those numbers, which ever works for you, and you will have the opportunity here to talk with our guest. 333-9455 and a toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Rybacki, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I am absolutely fantastic. I just got back from California for some hospital consulting, so I'm in Maryland freezing, to be honest. But I'm going to get over that, and I should never say freezing to people in Illinois.
Well, we've actually had a relatively, January. We actually had the warmest January on record. But now it's getting back to more like what we would expect it to be. So we're soldiering along.
Ah, there we go. The adventure continues.
Well, as I say, I'm really pleased that you could spend some time talking with us. We'll see what kind of questions people have who are listening. Something that I thought I might ask you about, the interest here was just touched off by a story that was on the front page of the New York Times yesterday. And this concerns sleep medication and the fact that apparently over the last, say, 5-6 years.
Big number of users.
Yep. And according to the story, about 42 million sleeping pill prescriptions were filled last year, and that was up nearly 60% since 2000. And there are apparently some people who look at these numbers and are a little bit concerned that maybe these medicines are being overprescribed and that not enough attention is paid to potential side effects and problems with their use. And I thought maybe it might be interesting for people who are listening to have you talk just a little bit about sleep medicines and are there particular concerns associated with their use?
Absolutely. When you look at this, we are a nation who tends to undersleep first and foremost, and it has probably absolutely nothing to do with all the caffeine that we drink and our busy lives and the stressors that we have, but of course that's an obvious correlation. And when I read that same article with interest in a couple senses, it's something that we tend to underestimate our needs for. And if you look at sort of the average, let's ballpark it, let's try to get 8 hours of sleep a night, I would bet if we polled 1,000 of our listeners, they'd say, pardon me, how much? And so it becomes the question, well, is a pill the answer or not? And I think the more rational approach to start is looking at stopping caffeine-containing beverages after about 6 p.m., usual thing I would talk to people about who were considering those medications, and then looking at, is this short-term use? Are there stressors that are going on in your life that are adding to this? Is there enough exercise that you're getting? Because obviously that sort of daily exercise, which I'm a major proponent of, not only helps diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, but it'll also help you sleep a little bit better if you're getting enough exercise. The other kind of components that you look at are, what do we look at in our day? And is this a regular amount of sleep, a regular time to bed? And what do you do if you can't sleep? So the question of the pills come up. The concerns with the pills is that over time, there's some newer ones that have been approved that are approved for longer term. Some of the older ones were concerning addiction and those sorts of things, or continued use despite resolution of the problem. So it's a conundrum of things. It's an involved issue, and it tends to affect most of our lives, hence the, gee, should we get these or not?
Something else that also, when I was looking around for things to talk about, caught my eye, and this actually goes back to the end of last year, and also concerns sleep medicines. And this has to do apparently with a study where they took a look at particularly this newer class of medicines that includes Sonata, Ambien, and Lunesta. And they looked at those as well as a one that's chemically similar to that which is available in Canada. And what they apparently found was that all of those medicines worked better than placebo in trying to help people who are having trouble sleep. But the other side of this was that what they didn't think that any of these drugs was any better than any of the others. That is, you pick one, pick your choice. Yes, it may provide you some help, and it works better than the placebo. But they're saying that Ambien's not better than Lunesta, Lunestin's not better than Sonata. They're all kind of the same.
And the interesting point in that, if you look at that homogenous sort of results-oriented, outcomes-based, like a nerdy person like me would say, well, okay, considering that, then what would it come down to? It would come down to the formulary that your insurance has, or whichever is less expensive in an acquisition cost. And, of course, the other kind of fine points in therapeutics involved in the sleep medicines themselves are, that's why your doctor needs to come into that, and some patients question the need for repeated follow-up, but it's, is this a problem falling asleep? Is this a problem waking up after you've fallen asleep? Is it a problem with frequent awakening? Some of these relate to urinary tract issues. Am I getting up and going to the bathroom 5 or 6 or 7 times? What's going on with that? And obviously in men, that can be a benign prostatic hypertrophy, those sorts of issues. So sorting it all out, it was interesting, and that outcomes data was interesting as well. There was some recent data looking at medicines for high cholesterol as well, and the same sort of focus, comparing dose to dose, saying, well, it looks like as long as you're taking one, you can lower your cholesterol, and same sort of idea with the sleep meds. Yeah, it looks like the risk-benefit sorts of things are about the same considerations, and if you're not sleeping, you'll get a benefit, but is it a cure? No, and as I've said so many times, a pill is not the answer. It's part of a combination of answers usually, and you have to look at what happens over time and benefits and side effects.
Yeah. Well, it also gets me thinking about the fact that if you look at particular classes of medicines, and say it could be sleep aids, could be cholesterol-lowering drugs, could be drugs for people who have acid reflux, could be, you know, a number of things where you have several medications that are chemically different enough so that they're patentable as distinct drugs, and yet they are close enough so that as far as clinicians are concerned, they're all the same. And when they make their prescribing decisions, often it's, as you say, it may have to do with whatever they've decided that's going to be in their formulary. So people who are in an HMO and get a prescription drug benefit,
sure,
they don't get any of them. Somebody has decided this is the one. Or it could, in another case, it could simply be about price. So then the doctor could say, here are three drugs. As far as I'm concerned, they're all the same. So we might as well prescribe the one that's going to cost the least. Or if we're going to buy a billion of them, the one that the manufacturer will give us the best deal on. So I guess partly my question, and it's based on, I think there are anecdotal evidence that people will say, well, yeah, maybe you claim that they're all the same, but I think drug A works better for me than drug B. I mean, is it things that are chemically the same, and if the doctors say, as far as I'm concerned, they're all the same, that doesn't necessarily work that way when you start taking them.
Let's just bring a big word out here, pharmacogenomics. And when you look at receptors and receptors constellations and what my parents gave to me genetically, if I said to you, gee, you know, David, I think the dose in you is going to be 30 milligrams of medication X, I may be wrong depending on how you metabolize that particular medicine, how, if it's removed by the kidneys, how well your kidneys work, how in pain is actually a very good example. They're looking at different kinds of receptors and the way people are sort of genetically wired in both sudden or acute pain and chronic pain. And when you think about that, how one person responds to a particular medication, some people in my own family, for example, have very strong sensitivities to analgesics. And what would be, quote, a normal dose in most anyone, if you look on a milligram per kilogram basis, some people are very, very almost obtunded by what would be a normal dose of a typical pain medicine. I mean, and considering families, again, you're exactly right in the sense of evidence-based and looking at outcomes. If your doctor says, well, you know, there's five different medicines in this particular family, and looking at the specifics of the medicines with usual goals, you know, cholesterol lowering, good cholesterol increasing, I think this and this and this are all about the same, then that's a decision you make probably based on exactly as you said, that cost and formulary penetration. And when you look at it using it over time, you always got to follow up. And the answer becomes, well, are there adverse effects that are more likely in one or the other, given you and your own family history and your own history as it unfolds?
Well, I think that it is also true, though, that if you take a look at these families of drugs that are considered by physicians to be essentially the same, and that, in fact, even if you take a look at the listed potential side effects, those things that are on the package insert that would be in your book, that would be in the PDR, that in fact, they, in terms of potential downsides, they're not the same. It seems to me that in fact, you can find things that are something that's listed for one of these medicines that's not listed as a side effect for another one.
Sure, and maybe more frequent, and that's where actually the nuances come in. And in the Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, also in the Medicines in Your Family Heart book that I've written, looking at what happens with those fine points in therapy, what happens with small or relative percent benefits or differences in side effects, that then can become that, and gee, that's a lot of what I do on a daily basis, is to try to figure out for which patient the group of medicines that are available and the particular medicine from that family become the better situation. I mean, if you look at it with some patients, what do we have a problem with in this country? Well, I got to take these pills every day. It becomes adherence compliance. And so if you look at, for example, in osteoporosis medications, and you look to 2005 and approvals, well, what did you have before? You had medicine in a particular family, and if you look at bisphosphonates, you look at the ones that were out there for a while. Well, there was a once-a-week therapy. That was an interesting thing, instead of a once-daily therapy. And then in March of last year, a once-a-month therapy came out, Ibandronate, was approved for postmenopausal osteoporosis. And so that question becomes, well, is Jim Rybacki going to take this medicine? If he's going to take it once a week, or is it going to be better, or for Mrs. Rybacki more appropriately in considering osteoporosis, is it going to be better to have that once-a-month medicine? And the answer sort of there depends on the patient, obviously the reimbursement for the formulary and the insurance, but it doesn't do you any good if it's going to stay in the bottle. So we have to think about that and weigh that as one of the factors as well.
Let me just introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Dr. James Rybacki. He's a member of the clinical faculty at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy. He's also board certified in pain management at the diplomat level by the American Academy of Pain Management. He's actively involved in the post-marketing monitoring of medicines via the Drug Surveillance Network. It's a nationwide association of clinical pharmacists. He's also president of the Clearwater Group. It's a consulting group that provides information, support, and clinical pharmacy services to physicians, to consumers, to employers. They hold seminars on medical cost containment, on outcomes research, on infectious disease, on osteoporosis, on pain management, and provide information to insurance companies, HMOs. They produce educational tapes on medicines, and he spent a lot of time thinking about keeping up with what's new with prescription drugs, and is the author of this book now that has been published every year with an update for quite a number of years. The new edition is out. It's The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs 2006. HarperCollins, the publisher. You can find it in the bookstore. And if you have questions about prescription medications, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, this gets me thinking about the position that physicians are in, I'm sure that they try to keep up with what's new and what's going on with prescription drugs, but it's not their only concern. They're trying to keep up, and particularly, say, if you were a family practice doctor, you've got to keep up with everything. Somebody exactly. like you, this is prescription drugs, that's your main focus. So you're spending all of your time thinking about that and the other kinds of things that you do. So that makes me think, you know, what exactly is a physician to do in making his prescribing decisions? And then are you really, as a physician, mostly in the position of having to rely on whatever your patient is telling you about what they're feeling? Does the medication seem to be having the desired effect? Is there any particular problem? And if there seems to be a problem, you know, how do we figure out if it's the medicine, if it's something else? I think that it sounds to me like that puts a doctor in a really tough spot.
Well, without doubt, because there's a certainty in medicines and healthcare, and it's called change. And, you know, if you look at the constellation of medicines that have been approved over the last couple of years, and then also look at some of the surprises in side effects that came out, and FDA, very appropriate FDA releases, again, our listeners can find that at www.fda.gov, and you can actually search for possible new side effects as well as medication approvals and modifications to drug labels themselves. And I guess to be succinct, the clearest focus for information about medicines comes from well-designed, rigorous scientific studies, hopefully comparative studies, looking at particular medicines in the same family. And, you know, when you look at those, I think, you know, the American Heart Association, www.americanheart.org, and some of their publications, circulation comes to mind often, JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, in looking at, there was a study of 4 patients, and we found that our drug was 50% better. Well, that's not real scientific rigor. And when you look at a big study of some 4,000 patients studied over an appropriate period of time for possible side effects, that's when you start looking at real outcomes and real results. And the challenge, of course, for any family practitioner is keeping up with all of that. I have a hard time doing it, and I'm in this stuff every day. It's remarkable looking at the gamish of things, not to mention conferences and the other kinds of things that come out that many patients get, which are basically, in many cases, from the web and are unsubstantiated small number of patient claims that are made. This happens a lot in herbal products and those sorts of things. And we need to rely on robust data and real medicine and real evidence to make those decisions.
Well, let's talk with a caller here. We have someone with a question on our line number 1. This is Champagne.
Hello. Hi, good morning.
Yes.
Hi, good morning.
Yes, I have a couple of issues, and I need your advice or see just to see what you think. But our patients oftentimes use as guinea pigs.
Now, guinea pigs in the sense of...
Some of these prescriptions, because I went to my doctor. I was having, neck pains, and obviously it was stress. And I think she gave me, muscle relaxants for horses or something, and she gave me a huge bottle of them. You know, even though she's known me and she knows I don't take many medications, I don't really like taking them unless I have to. And, I took one or two, and it just didn't feel right, and I just stopped taking them. And I threw the whole bottle away, and it cost me $30.
Well, I guess there are a couple questions in that. First of all, in looking at pains in the neck, which you kind of just presented, these came on suddenly, or they just
built up over time, I think. Okay. Yeah.
And you thought they were stress-related. Well, you know, muscle relaxant in that sense, and a reasonable trial of them is not an unusual presentation of it. It sounds like there was if they were really horse, but you mean they were large size?
They were huge, yes.
Okay. I was thinking, my God, I hope this wasn't somebody giving you veterinary pills for a human condition.
I tell you, it's like, that's why, I mean, I'm leery of the medical profession, unfortunately, you know, because sometimes I need, you know, at my age, I'm starting to feel that I need to go more often. Like, for example, I went to take a TB test. Mm-hmm. The nurse, all she had to do was look at my file to see that I had been positive before.
Okay.
And she went ahead and did it anyway, and I got a huge swelling.
Oh, I bet you did. And for our listeners, what happens, a lot of times, these are called TB time tests, and what's done is an extract of tuberculosis is actually put into the skin, mm-hmm. and your body, if it has been exposed to tuberculosis, has a reaction to that. Well, it sounds like, in a couple senses, I'm surprised that they would place another test if you had been positive previously.
And all you had to do was look at my file, and it was there.
And, it's always okay for you as a patient to say, well, you know, I've been positive before. Is this something we need to go ahead with?
Well, I told her, unfortunately, because I'm... You know, that's another issue I think that's a big deal is that patients, we are not really well informed. And so I couldn't remember, I wasn't sure, and I told her that. And all she had to do was go into my files and look.
And again, you know, it's always okay to ask the same question again. And if you're truly uncomfortable, to say, well, could I talk to the doctor about that?
Well,
and can you check my chart? And maybe we ought not to place this.
But then every doctor visit, they want to charge you all this money, you know. So it's like, it's just a vicious circle of money.
Sure, and you're in some sense struck with getting a little bit older, it sounds like, and I've certainly done the same thing. And you're exactly right in that it becomes much more important to have regular checkups, particularly if you have a strong family history, diabetes, heart disease.
Exactly. But then isn't it like the nurses, I think, you know, shouldn't they look at your file if they're going to thinking of doing something to you to see a little bit about...
Well, that's a reasonable and prudent step, and it's also something as a patient in advocating for yourself, it's okay to say, well, oh, gee, where am I now, and what do we need to do, and is this something that relates to a test I've had before? Those are always fair questions to ask.
Exactly, and then the doctor wanted me to take, because I tested positive, obviously, all of a sudden she wanted me to take some kind of medication, I don't remember what it was called, because apparently, you know, how the... when you're dormant, there's 10% chance of people who have TB and it's dormant for it to blow up. And so they have this medication now that you can take, but it has effects on your liver. One of the side effects can be liver
issues. Well, I think what you're talking about is probably one of the combination. Because tuberculosis in general in this country has become pretty resistant, usually what happens is if there's positive tests and then culture confirmed positive, they'll start a series of medicines, and you're right, they can be hard on your liver, but it's wholly appropriate to start them.
Particularly. Yeah, but again, my doctor knew I had been hepatitis A at some point in time.
Okay.
And I had had my blood test all taken, and she didn't even make reference to that.
Well,
it was already medicating me this stuff.
Let's go back to hepatitis A, though. Hepatitis A, in general, for our listeners, is a somewhat benign kind of hepatitis. The two hepatitises we hear about more commonly is hepatitis B and hepatitis C.
Mm-hmm.
And most cases of hepatitis A are mild and self-limiting. And looking at the effect of that on your liver over time, your doctor may have appropriately concluded that based on some tests that you got, some blood work that he or she got, that your liver was fine enough to start the therapy.
Well, but then the problem is that she never sat down and explained this to me. I had to go to
a nurse. And you were uncertain,
social,
like.
At the social department, and she was kind enough to sit down and explain the situation to me, and that's how I found out about the blood test, because my doctor had all these results, and so I have to wonder if she ever even saw them. She's not going to talk to me about them, you know?
Well, you know, that's a difficulty in many busy physician practices.
Well, that's the problem.
If you went through the entire thing,
Yeah, but the thing is, we're all very busy.
Oh, no,
you know?
Exactly. And I've done office space.
By the fact that the doctor, you know, that the medical professions and, you know, and I'm not going to mention any institutions here, but it's one of the large ones in this town. And we all know who that is. And so I am just like, I'm at this point where I'm going to go to a private doctor. I'm not going to work with these large HMO institutions because I don't trust them.
Well, it sounds like you're very frustrated. And I think for any patient, any caller, it's always okay to ask repeated questions. It's always okay to ask how your individual history and medications you've taken before and tests you've had before impact what they want to consider now.
Sure.
And if you don't ever feel like you've got all the information, it's okay to ask for more time because, unfortunately, given...
But when a nurse tells you, you know, I'm not going to give you copies of your records, and is rude about it.
Well, that's actually a patient right. It's okay
I'm like,
to ask for copies of your records.
I have to go pay to get my medical records. You know?
And it also is reasonable for a, quote, usual and customary fee to be charged for that in some cases where copies are requested. And it sounds like you're frustrated by the whole thing.
Absolutely.
And it sounds like, based on your experience, if there wasn't time or there were labs that were within normal values and they weren't discussed with you, that's the downside of incomplete information.
Absolutely. And the thing is that I spent the money to get all the tests done, to mm-hmm. have everything checked, so that
right.
that information would be available for any future reference, and it's, mm-hmm. and it's not used.
One of the other
things, it's not explained to me. So
sure, one of the other things that's coming up are electronic medical records, EMRs, and those are things that in some centers they actually give you a copy of your medical file on a chip, and you
mm-hmm.
take it with you to your next practitioner, wherever you go see,
mm-hmm.
and that's something that I strongly believe in. Obviously, that's pretty cutting edge and pretty high tech, mm-hmm. but you run into HIPAA sort of issues where, you know, whose records are they and who can they go to?
Yeah.
But actually getting that information and providing it in a computerized form then gives you the benefit of having all that and going to the next person, not having to say, well, gee, let's take the next half an hour and go through my history. Here is my history, and let me
right.
give that to you ahead of time. That can be a really good strategy for dealing with that.
Well, I think that definitely, I believe that as patients, we definitely and now have to take a lot more responsibility and be more aware. It's not just the doctors who have to be, you know, on top of everything, but us too, you know,
well,
have to be aware of what's going on and what kind of drugs were being prescribed, you know, because I just couldn't believe that my doctor had given me all of these muscle relaxants, a huge bottle full of them, you know, like I was going to be taking all of these drugs, you know.
Let me give you one more bit of advice in that. When that happens and you're considering a trial of a new medication, it's perfectly okay to ask for samples. Do you have any samples of that? And so I can try these for a certain amount of time to see how well I tolerate them. That, in general, is what that whole sampling approach was made for. And then before you go ahead and spend a significant amount of money on something you're uncertain of, you could have, in essence, a trial of that and a written prescription that you could fill. And the other end of that is that if for some reason you're not tolerating a particular medicine that's been prescribed, it's also important, and part of you advocating for yourself as a patient, to go back and place a call to that doctor and say, well, you know what, Dr. Smith, this is what I'm feeling. This is what's happened. I really am uncomfortable filling that prescription. So where can we go next? And those are more than fair questions.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller for her comments. I hope
Absolutely.
She will forgive me for jumping in here because we're past our midpoint, so we're more than halfway through the show. And I have somebody else who is waiting, and I
okay.
want to encourage some other people who want to call in. Also, Dr. Rebecca, if you wouldn't mind, just we're going to take a moment here to encourage people to support this radio station.
Oh, as well they should.
And in addition to trying to do our regular show, as we usually do, this is one of those times during the year that we try to remind people just how important listener financial support. That doesn't just mean moral support, like you've listened to us and you like us, but that you help pay the bills. Listener financial support, very important to this public radio station, your public radio station. So we hope that if you have not yet done it, you would take the opportunity to call in a different number from this program. The number is 244-9455. Call in and make a pledge, a financial pledge to WILL to help pay for Focus 580, Afternoon Magazine, All Things Considered, Morning Edition, whatever programs are really important to you. Jack Brighton is here in the studio with me. He's a former producer of the show. He's now the guy who oversees all of our web activities.
Right. And I used to produce this show, which I absolutely love listening to still, mainly for the content that you have. I mean, I was just listening to your guest, James Rebecca, talking about answering questions about prescription drugs, really informed, really helpful. And where else are you going to get this stuff? You look around at the rest of the mainstream media and you see, you know, Runaway Bride and Michael Jackson and, you know, the shouting head talk shows. Well, this is the real deal. I mean, in those other most of the rest of the media is still kind of a vast wasteland. It's more of a placebo, whereas this is the real stuff. So we hope that you appreciate that and will support it with your membership contribution, $40 at the basic membership level for a year. And you can do that right now by giving a call to our pledge line, 217-244-9455, especially if you've never pledged before. We really hope to hear from you during Focus 580. Kimberly Chronic is in our pledge center, and I don't think we have any phones ringing. Kimberly, what can we do to get them ringing?
Well, we need listeners to go to the phone right now and call 217-244-9455. We've got Sherry, Ruth, Millie, and Heather standing by to take your call. And you know, Jack, You know, this is such a great service. I mean, that's why you're listening. That's why folks are listening. But we don't only not only bring you great national programming, but we have local news. We have talk programs like the one you're listening to today, as well as in the afternoon magazine. So we really involve our listeners in our radio programs, a service that is interactive, that's responsive. That's what you get. And we know you appreciate that. We want to hear from 10 callers by 11 o'clock today. We need to raise about $10,000 more today to reach our goal of having raised $32,000 by the end of today. So that's about $10,000. So, hey, if there's 10 callers out there that want to give $1,000, go for it. But really, the basic membership is just $40. So for those who can afford $40 or even more, go to the phone right now and make a pledge for all those reasons and reasons of your own that we haven't mentioned. 217-244-9455. Bring your Visa, MasterCard, Discover, or American Express, or go to our web address and pledge there, willpledge.org.
Willpledge.org.
So we don't want you to miss any of this program. So call right now while the lines are open and give us a call, 244-9455.
All right. Thank you very much, Jack and Kim. Back with our guest, James Rabacki. He is a member of the clinical faculty at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy. And he is the author of a book that has been published now annually with updates for quite a few years, and the new edition is out. It's The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs 2006. It's published by HarperCollins, and it has information on many prescription medicines, what they're for, potential side effects, things that you should watch out for in terms of drug interactions between various medications that you may be taking, and also it also does have information on over-the-counter supplements, some of those kinds of things that people can get without a prescription. And there, again, you do need to keep in mind that there are potential interactions between that and other things that you may be taking. So it's a good source of information on medicines that may well have been prescribed for you, for your kids, for members of your family. So you can check it out. And we do have a couple of other callers here who are waiting patiently to get on. So let's do that, and we'll talk next with someone in Urbana. And this is a caller on line number two.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Yes.
Yeah, I sort of learned the hard way about the sample bit. I had an illness a while back and finally found out the guy says, well, I'll just give you samples after I would spend money on prescriptions. But I wanted to ask you something about, you were talking earlier to the other caller about information, how information is handled, your medical information, your history, and stuff like that.
Sure.
And years ago, I read in biotech journals about companies like called Affymetrics, which make, the theory was they could make what they call DNA on a chip, where they would, you know, give you a blood sample, and
sure,
it would analyze this and say, well, you can take this drug won't work, that kind of stuff, sort of, you know, taking you out of the loop, trying to remember if your grandfather died of something or had some sort of illness. And mm-hmm. Do you know the status of that stuff? Is that gotten any farther than I remember about 3 years ago?
It's interesting. Yeah, there's actually a cytochrome P450, sort of a how things are metabolized genotype. And looking at the emerging field of pharmacogenomics, I would expect in the next 3 to 5 years, you'll see a lot more of that, because part of the challenge is not only what happens genetically and what are you at risk for, mm-hmm. But it also looks at what happens with particular medicines, how you metabolize them. Some of the other prediction sort of things are actually more marker-driven, and what I mean by that, in June of 05, there was actually a blood test approved by the FDA that, I'm sorry for the name, but it's a myeloperoxidase.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Prognostics. And this actually helps differentiate sort of a chest pain indigestion from, are you at heart attack risk? And it sort of comes in the milieu of, well, what does your body make when it's starting to get sick?
Mm-hmm.
And part of that looks at inflammation. Part of it looks at what does, if you look at, there's a lipoprotein-associated phospholipase A2, which is more than a mouthful, but there's a plaque test, if you will, that can help predict risk of stroke. And those particular things, in combination with markers like C-reactive protein, things that we know about or have been more established versus the emerging pieces, you know, help put together that constellation of risk and define who's at risk and then should we be more aggressive with available medicines.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I think in a way, I'm looking at medicine now because I really never really went to doctors other than every couple of years I'd go to a physical until I had this, I was exposed to a virus and I got this sort of weird reaction to it.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing I found was that everybody kind of was the blind put in the tail on the donkey thing, and I would tell them I have this, and they go, well, that's probably not it. But it's starting to me like if there would be you think we're on the cusp of this major change, like you said, 2 or 3 years, where people will be able to, medical profession will be able to give us more accurate answers. Do you think that might be true, or is that still going to be?
No, I think that there's certainly a bunch of tests emerging in the sense of actually being able to pull up your genome and say, you know what, here's exactly what you're at risk for, yeah. Here's what's going to happen. Unfortunately, all of the genes looking at human disease haven't been perfectly characterized. And so looking at particular, what comes to mind, the HER2 thing with breast cancer, those sorts of genetics and genomics are starting to become more well-known. They're actually targeted therapies there. Looking at a medicine called imatinib or Gleevec, that actually was targeting a gastrointestinal stromal tumor, another mouthful, but basically turning off a gene that was then saying, gee, what are we going to do? It also was looking at some leukemia effects, which was very, very targeted, which is a little bit different than risk. But if you look at that particular person, and if you can define that particular genome, then what you've got by diagnosis and then by the effect of the gene is a therapy that actually switches off the gene, which is fundamentally amazing to me. If I had said that 5 years ago, you would have said, Jim, what are you talking about?
Yeah, I agree with you. I just want to say, hey, thanks a lot. This is very interesting. But I like I said, when I went through this process, and I felt like I was stumbling along, sort of finally found out what my problem was. But the thing is that it was interesting to go through the process and look back on it. And I really didn't dislike the medical profession like some people say, I'm never going to doctors again, because I think that's sort of like, they really, it's an amazing what they can do to help you if they know what's wrong with you. But, hey, thanks a lot.
All right,
great
well,
show, David.
Thanks for the
bye.
Call. We'll go on here. We'll talk with someone next in Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Thank you. In the area of pain remedies, I sort of recall something that was used topically, DMSO. Could you make any comments on its efficacy or danger?
Well, DMSO is interesting in the sense that this was used as a carrier for a number of years in veterinary medicine, and dimethyl sulfoxide, in the sense of what it actually does, has been something that's always been sort of in a gray zone. Interestingly, if you put some combinations of medicines into a suspension with DMSO, they can be moved into the body somewhat more easily, but what are you trying to do with that particular medicine, and what sort of pain is it?
Well, just if you had a little sprain or here or there, and occasionally it is sort of remedied. It. I was wondering, but we were concerned years ago about the danger of it, and you should only be using especially refined, purified form because of its possible effect on other areas. Just as a pain remedy for a sprain or a strain.
Right, and in that sense, looking at the benefit to risks, more people would say, you know, something like a counter-irritant, some of the icy hot sorts of things of the world would be a safer thing to use for a minor
sprain. What would the item to be used?
Some of the icy hot things, the counter-irritants, the rubs, and, you know, the simple thing, obviously in the sense of a sprain, looking at cold, and then...
Well, how about another comment on another area, like homeopathic items like arnica that's been promoted as a sports injury type of alleviating remedy, ointment or cream or tablet. Does homeopathy still stand in questionable...
Well, in the sense of looking at outcomes-based information, when you look at evidence-based medicine for herbals and those sorts of things, you actually have something in National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine. You can find that at www.nccam.nih.gov. And part of the idea behind homeopathy was using small amounts of compounds to get a response. And in the sense of looking at specific compounds, that's where I would go to look for that. Back to DMSO just briefly, there is some interstitial cystitis use for that medicine. And some possible use in amyloidosis, but the other possibilities with how this might happen and how exactly it works and looking at the possible drowsiness, nausea, those sorts of things, that benefit to risk was more in favor of going with other agents.
Thank you.
All right. Sure. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dr. James Rybacki. He's a member of the clinical faculty at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy and is the author of the book, The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs for 2006. Something else I thought that I would ask you about, and I came across a story dealing with this, and I'm sure it's something that you thought about and talked about, and that is pill splitting. And it goes to the idea that, and you know, I don't understand how exactly this could be, but the fact that there are some medications that are available in various dosages and
all the same cost. Yep.
And that I don't understand why that should be. But, you know, for example, Lipitor, you can get it in 20, 40 or 80 milligram tabs and they all cost the same. So the idea is that some people realize, well, I can save some money here if, for example, if I'm supposed to take 20 milligrams a day, I can go out and I can buy the 40 milligram tabs. I can split them in half. And suddenly now I've halved my cost. Well, there's also, I guess, some concern among the pharmaceutical industry that there are potential problems connected with that. And I can also understand, you know, that might, depending on how good you are at splitting the pills, that might create some problems for dosage and, you know, maybe. So there could be all kinds of problems associated with this. And I guess I'm wondering what your thought is generally on the subject of pill splitting.
It's interesting you brought up that particular class of medications, looking at the HMG reductase inhibitors, the statin family for abnormal cholesterol. There was an interesting paper at the American Heart Association actually talking about the cost-benefit of pill splitting, and there, where the exact dose in the sense of if you're going to split pills, get a pill splitter, obviously, and talk to your doctor about that. The question of, and I've got that in the Essential Guide, some medicines that should be never split, extended-release formulations, some of the other kinds of medicines, you have to make sure you don't have one in that class. But when you look at exactly as you're talking about that possibility of pills and splitting them, that was in that particular paper at AHA cited as a way to save some money on the medicines and get equivalent outcomes. Where you wouldn't want to do that is where you actually require a very specific drug level in a very small range, what's called a narrow therapeutic window medicine, and that's something, again, you need to talk to your doctor about to make sure that you don't have one of those medicines that you might be considering splitting. Hmm. Interesting question.
Then I guess I still don't. I find it difficult to understand why and how it is that the manufacturers can do this and have a 20 milligram tab and an 80 milligram tab and sell them for the same. Obviously, there's more medicine, so their cost is. That makes me wonder about the whole pricing and cost structure of the medicine if they're going to sell you a 20 milligram tab and an 80 milligram tab for the same price.
It is an interesting question. I'm not sure I've ever understood that myself as well. But certainly, where that's a U.S. manufactured product and something that you have in your pharmacy that you've gotten with a prescription, the approach of actually having the same price and increasing by a factor of two the medicines you're going to be taking, I think it's an interesting strategy without doubt.
Well, let's talk with some other folks here. Let's
okay.
go to someone listening in Pontiac on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Hi.
Without being way too general about or way too specific about it, I have a couple of chronic conditions, fibromyalgia and manic depressant syndrome. So I'm taking pain medication, sleeping medication, and obviously a depressant or antidepressant.
Are you able to exercise as well? Is that something your doctor's tried?
It's not something that is working right now.
Okay.
I seem to just be going into more flares. My question is, everything's falling apart, but I have been diagnosed with glaucoma here about 8 months ago, and I've had two laser treatments so far, which the second one does not seem to be helping. And there's a good possibility I'm going to have to go to a glaucoma medication that's put in as an eye drop. I don't know a specific type yet, but
often they're beta blockers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I've heard there may be some potential interactions with some of the other medications I'm taking, and I'm just managing to go from day to day with the other medications, so I'm really concerned about the possibility of a bad interaction here.
Okay, here's the way to address this. You take a list of all of your medications. I've actually advocated medication mapping in the Essential Guide, but a simple list is very easy. Do you go to one pharmacy for all your medicines? Where do you get your medicines?
Honestly, my insurance demands that I go to a mail order.
Okay, and then I think this is a really good patient advocacy question in the sense that call the mail order pharmacy. They've got to give you an 800 number for that and ask them to run a drug interactions check, a drug disease interactions check on all of your medicines. That's a good thing to do on a regular basis anyway, to have someone do that for you. And then whenever your prescriber decides what medicine they're going to be using for glaucoma, ask them the same thing. And make sure you ask that pointed question and ask it specifically. They often have drug information departments in the mail order pieces themselves, and that's something you absolutely have a right to ask for.
Okay, is the caller still there? Obviously, it sounds like the caller's on a cell phone, and we're kind of breaking up there, and I'm hoping that we...
I had a little trouble hearing, but you know, it's okay to ask. And before adding a non-prescription medicine to especially a complicated group of medicines, I had a patient recently in Florida and had 16 prescription medicines and 7 herbals, and there were 6 different drug interactions. And it seems relatively innocent many times to add on that herbal product. But, for example, there was a warning out on some Brazilian diet pills from the FDA in that those pills actually had prescription components in them that were tranquilizers, antidepressants, and stimulants. So that gamish of things that may be well packaged may not always be the best combination for the prescriptions that you're already taking.
Well, and it's good, as you say, it's a good idea to, at the very least, if you can, get all your prescriptions filled at the same place, because they should watch out for that, for potential interactions.
Well, exactly.
But also, it's good, you really should tell, you know, any doctor that's prescribing for you anything, you should tell them everything else that you're taking.
Absolutely. You know, and it's, you know, you run into that with medications for diabetes. Interestingly, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that, there was a recent approval of an inhaled insulin for diabetes. It's called Zubra, which is a fascinating step.
All right. Well, let's see if we can get one more caller in here. Champagne Line 1. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
A number of antidepressants and anxiety medications yeast weight gain as a side effect.
I couldn't hear you. The first thing was antidepressants, and what was the other one?
Medications yeast weight gain as a side effect.
Can they cause weight gain? Looking at antidepressants, that's one of the classic descriptions. And there's a question about the medicines themselves or the fact that many people, when they are depressed, lose a little bit of their appetite. And so there's that weight loss, but it's becoming part of being depressed. So when you fix the depression, if you will, then your diet and your willingness to eat may increase a little bit. One of the medications for depression, Wellbutrin, has possibly a neutral to a little bit of weight loss with it. So, yeah, that is a possibility.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Right, thanks. So we are just about at the point that we have to finish up here.
The time flies by.
It does. And I just want to, I'm really appreciate you giving us the time.
Absolutely.
This seems to be something that people always have questions about. So perhaps we can find some time again sometime in the future.
I would love to do that. But the other thing I would like, let me have that number to make a donation, because I'm going to do that today for you.
No, you really don't have to do that.
I know you don't have to. I want to. Could I have the number, please?
Yes, sir. Sure. It's 217-244-9455.
Okay. Excellent. I'll probably get a little bumper sticker. It'll be on the back of my car, and people will go, Jim, where's that?
You bet. Well, and I want to thank you, Dr. Rybacki, very much for talking
my
with
pleasure.
Us. And for people who are looking for information on medicines they may be taking, You can look for the book that we have mentioned. The new edition is out now. It's The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs 2006. It's published by HarperCollins. Our guest is the author, Dr. James Rybacki. He is member of the clinical faculty at University of Maryland School of Pharmacy. He also, by the way, has a website which does have information on prescription medicines. And I think also there's an opportunity there to ask questions, and that's www.medicineinfo.com. That's all as one word, medicineinfo.com.